Do we live in a culture of fear? I think that every day Americans hear about things that are designed to freak them out, designed to make you fearful and worried about your everyday life, about your health, about your security, about all those things. I think we've become far too anxious a nation because of all of these things that are pounded into our brain on a regular basis. That's why I was very interested in reading a new book by Dr. Mark Siegel. It's called False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. And he knows a little bit about this because he was working in a hospital in New York City on 9/11/01. And so I've invited him to talk about all of these things a little bit this afternoon here on KMOX. Mark, thanks for doing the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So what is it that we're afraid of?
Well, you know, I think everybody that's listening should ask themselves the following question. Do they think that things are safer now or less safe than they were 100 years ago? Because I think, you know, there are things to worry about, but I think that we worry about the wrong things. And I think 100 years ago, we didn't live as long, and we didn't live as safely. I mean, in those days, a scratch could kill you. We didn't even have antibiotics. So, you know, my message is, yes, there are things to worry about, but we're in a climate where we worry about everything. I think that that has gotten a lot worse since September 11th, 2001, because we've basically decided we're more vulnerable than we thought we were. We feel susceptible to everything that comes down the pike or that we hear about in the news. And the key thing is, because we're a society of voyeurs, we personalize all information about possible danger.
You know, it's funny you say that because this morning I was sitting in my home office working on some stuff for the show today, looking through your book, and one of the local TV stations was taking a live shot of this small plane that was having some trouble. It had taken off from one suburban airport here and was forced to land at the big airport here, Lambert, 2.5 hours later, even though, you know, it was going elsewhere, but they had a problem with the landing gear. And so this TV station put it on the air live, and the only reason you put that on the air live is because you're hoping something bad will happen, or you want to be sure that you see it if something bad would happen. And that's the voyeuristic side of, I think, every American.
You know, Paul, I totally agree with that. I did an experiment on myself last night because I'm into the fear issue. I watched it, too. I watched the plane that had a problem with its landing gear and a little bit of a door. And, you know, the ultimate outcome was that it wasn't really anything that much to worry about, and it was fine, although it was an old plane. And I watched them to continue the coverage for a good hour after that was discovered that it really was a false alarm, like my book's title is. And yet I kind of checked my own pulse, and I realized I'm due to take a plane flight in a couple of weeks, and I felt less secure about it than before I saw those photos. But what are we talking about here? I mean, that was one plane flight out of how many thousands in the United States yesterday?
Right.
And how safe is a plane? We alter our perception by focusing and obsessing on certain items in the news.
Now, you mentioned that you perceive it to be much worse since 9/11/01. Interestingly, since we're now in our war on terrorism, everybody keeps saying, well, you know, if you don't do this, then the terrorists win. If you don't do that, then the terrorists win. Well, I would contend that if we've become more fearful, terror being part of terrorism means that they have won.
Yeah, I agree totally. And I think one of the things we keep leaving out of the equation is the actual definition of what terrorism is. Terrorists know that what terrorism is scaring you out of proportion to the risks. The tool of terrorists is fear, not bombs. I mean, a grizzled-looking Osama bin Laden or some other terrorist has the ability to scare you just by the visualization of it. There are things that are much more dangerous to us on a personal basis, you know, that we've gotten too used to, like the automobile. An automobile injures 50 million worldwide every year, but it looks very comfortable. It's got plush seats. It's got air conditioning. You know, metal looks very comfortable and safe. It's actually very unsafe. Terrorists actually scare you by their potential rather than what they actually do, and we all personalize it.
You've got a picture on the cover of False Alarm, people running away from the United States Capitol. They've grabbed all their stuff, and they're getting the heck out of there, their official credentials and everything. There are police making people hurry up and get away from there. I don't remember exactly when that was or what that incident was. What's that a photo of?
Well, that's one of the anthrax scares that occurred in 2003 after the actual anthrax mailing of 2001. It unleashed a series of of bioterror alerts that occurred, not just the orange alerts that we've been seeing on TV all the time, but there was a series of anthrax scares. And anthrax itself, of course, we were all afraid to open our mail in 2001. Turned out it was really only 22 people that got infected, and from there, rather than acknowledging that there was a vast overreaction based on a worst-case scenario, I mean, you know, I don't discount worst-case scenarios, but we seem to go from one to the next. Then it was smallpox, then it was West Nile virus, then it was SARS, mad cow disease. In each case, there's something scary, some item unknown, mysterious. You know, now it's the bird flu. Well, birds scare us because they swoop in from the sky, because they have beady little eyes, they have talons and claws. You know, but Alfred Hitchcock understood that, did an incredible movie about that. But when he was asked about it, he said, why would you scare people so much? He said, well, because they get to go home. This is just entertainment. But we don't get to go home from these news items.
Well, there are probably people in America who still have their Tom Ridge Memorial duct tape up on their windows and water left over from the Y2K scare.
Well, I mean, and I think it turned out in the end that I'm not trying to cast aspersions on Tom Ridge here, but it did turn out in the end that he was investing in a company that actually sold a lot of duct tape.
Now, let's go back to anthrax for a second, because you spent some time talking about it in the book, and you use the phrase anthrax fumble. Now, what does that mean?
Well, that's actually one of the things that caused this whole reaction in terms of one health scare after another. Because, you see, when anthrax mailing occurred, one of the things that became prominent in the public view was that the Centers for Disease Control didn't appear to handle it properly. They seemed to be caught napping. They were hearing things from news reports. They weren't part of the loop. And the head of the CDC at that time was fired and replaced by Dr. Gerberding. Well, they don't want to make that mistake again, to be caught napping or to be accused of being out of the loop. So I think they're overreacting by constantly, whenever an emerging disease occurs, getting up front with the press conferences and telling us how bad it can be. But, you know, there's a way to deliver information that puts it in context or provides it with perspective. And one of those ways is to admit or remember things in the past. There's no batting average. There's no accounting. You know, we scared you about SARS. We told you it was going to take over the planet because you had no immunity to it. But you know what? It only infected 7,000 people worldwide. That's not nothing, but, you know, it's not what we said. And so now here we are again. Let's remind you first that we did this before. Now, interestingly enough, with the bird flu, I go over the bird flu in a chapter in my book. In fact, I have an upcoming book coming out on the bird flu. But you know that there was a scare back in 1976 on the swine flu, very similar to what we're going through now. And we need to remember that. I mean, it doesn't mean something bad can't happen, but the public should try to remember the number of times they've been alarmed unnecessarily.
Yeah, and this one particularly with the bird flu, it's the first time in a long time I've seen so much attention to the word pandemic.
Ooh. Right, well, that's a scary word, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, it's going to get everybody. You can't possibly escape it. Are we ready for a bird flu pandemic? I can't tell you how many times I've seen that headline in newspapers or cable TV, you know, newscasts. Are we ready for a bird flu pandemic?
I mean, you know, the word pandemic, all the word actually means is that, few people have it in more than one place at one time. It doesn't even imply the number of people that have it. And by the way, we already have a pandemic in the world. It's called AIDS, and we're not even paying any attention to it anymore. We have a lot of, you know, diseases out there that really are things worth being scared of, and we're not afraid of them, and that's not right.
Well, I think we've come to terms with the risks involved with AIDS. There certainly was a lot of panic about AIDS in the 80s when it first started getting out there, and when we first learned that it wasn't just gay people who could get it, but heterosexuals were getting it. I mean, if you owned a stock in a condom-making company before 1985, you probably got rich between 1985 and 1995 because of the threat of AIDS, which was a valid threat, right?
You know, well, I agree with you about 95% of what you're saying here. I think in the United States we've become pretty savvy about AIDS, and I think one of the reasons that we've controlled it in at least several parts of the country is because of information. And I think fear was right earlier, and that now getting accustomed to it is good. On the other hand, worldwide, AIDS is out of control. And I'm concerned on a worldwide basis that if we put too much emphasis on bird flu, we could take some emphasis away from AIDS. And I'm not the only one that feels that way. But in the United States, I think we became accommodated to it, and I think you're right. But this is what we need for all diseases. We need information in perspective, not just scare tactics. I mean, you know, people will say, if you talk to infectious disease experts, they'll say, well, look, public awareness is too low. Let's get the public awareness raised up, and then we'll have funding for our programs. Well, my reply is, we'll find a way to inform the public accurately, realistically, without alarming them. Because you know what? There's a tremendous cost to fear. Fear is the most expensive virus going, and we see that all the time. You know that actually if there is a pandemic of any kind, it's fear that's going to cost the most money. Imagine what's going to happen if a single chicken in the United States gets this H5N1 virus. Nobody's going to eat chicken. Yep. The whole poultry industry is going to go down the tubes.
Talking with Mark Siegel, the book is called False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. Who's exploiting this?
Well, you know, I like to say, that, and you know, it's funny, I'm going to give you a disclaimer, then you'll say, well, maybe he's still saying conspiracy, but I don't view this as a conspiracy. I think it's more of a culture, like a fabric of fear that we have, and it has to do with agendas of very large domains in our country. Look, our leaders want us to believe that they're protecting us. One of the best ways to accomplish that is to create a danger that they have to protect us from. So they're benefiting. You're going to vote someone into office if they tell you terrorism is going to get you, but I'm preventing terrorism. You know, Iraq is going to get you, but I'm preventing Iraq from getting you. Whatever it is, if our leaders say that they can protect us and we believe them, we're going to vote for us. So the government is benefiting. Now, the private interests benefit because if you think you're afraid of something and you need some item to protect you, like Tamiflu or duct tape or Cipro, you know, or some pill, you know, some vaccine, you know, we need to see vaccines for what they really are, not for some panacea against fear. So that's how private interests, there's a great industry out there for people that are afraid. And the third thing is the media. And I think the media, you know, I'm a little naive here because I deal with the media a lot, and I find that most people in the media are genuine, and they're very serious, take their jobs very seriously, and they want to inform the public. But the media is a giant megaphone, and it sends a message, and it reverberates all over the internet and everywhere, and so I don't think the media knows its own power. Of course, in terms of ratings, nothing works better than fear.
Right. Yeah, you would think that with every story that gets blown out of proportion, there's got to be somebody behind the scenes saying, ooh, this is good. Let's run with this. Let's make this a big, big story. Even if it's not necessarily a big story, you know, you can create controversy. You can splash headlines. You can concentrate on it far more than it needs to be concentrated on. And the American viewer or reader or listener has to be affected by that psychologically.
Well, I mean, people are certainly afraid to travel to Aruba right now over one poor, unfortunate, you know, young woman, mm-hmm. which we all feel badly about. But let's face it, what does one event have to do with the entire island or even the whole Caribbean? I mean, I think that that's an example of one story that we obsess on. And, you know, it's called misdirection. We misdirect people away from what, you know, strangers committing crimes is something that really entices us. In reality, most crimes are committed by people we know.
That's why I don't know anybody. I have no crime. Mark, there's one group I think you left out there, and that's a group that I've railed against often on this show, Big Pharma, which to me has gotten out of control in the last several years. Whenever it was that they were allowed to start advertising things on TV and telling us to ask your doctor about, whenever that started, and it seems like it's within the last decade, I may be wrong there, but whenever that started, people have started being afraid that they've got who knows what, and they've got to go get a pill for it.
Well, I think it's what I call fear dependencies. And actually, it's very, very concrete. It's really what happens. You know, people rush to pills because they are told that they need this pill rather than alter their lifestyle. I mean, almost every pill is the case with that. We saw that with the arthritis drugs. I mean, it was shocking to find out that 23 million people took Celebrex in 2003. You know, whatever happened to aspirin? What happened to physical therapy? What happened to heat? You know, what happened to rest? I mean, these drugs are very, very overprescribed because a need is created and then the need is filled with a fear drug.
You're a doctor. You know what happened to all of those things. We want a magic pill for everything. I want a magic pill to make me lose weight. I want to have a magic pill that'll help me in the bedroom. I want a magic pill that'll make me less anxious. That's the American psyche. We don't. All those other things you mentioned, they take work. I don't want to have to put effort in. Make it easy. I want something I can pop in my mouth, swallow with some water. Boom, problem solved.
You know, in my book, I have a scene where somebody watches an ad on TV and sees a smiling person saying, "I was depressed until I took this pill." Well, I don't think the smiling, sexy young people are the ones doing that, but let's say that's the case. The patient went ahead and started on an antidepressant, and then he said, "You know, now I'm impotent. What do I do?" I said, "Here's another pill." You know, so in other words, one pill leads to another, which is another part of the problem. You get a side effect from the first pill, take a second pill.
While we're on the subject, I got to ask you, because you are an MD, you're a practicing internist, doesn't the medical community also have to share some blame for that? Because people, after all, have to go to somebody and get a prescription for all these things. Big Pharma is not forcing pills down people's mouths.
Well, I think that, you know, I might surprise you by saying I'm not a big defender of the medical community. I've done a lot of articles about exactly how doctors are to blame. But, you know, you brought up something that I do think is worse, which is the pressure that are put on doctors. I mean, in a managed care environment, patient comes running in here talking about what they saw on TV, and the quickest way to make them happy is to give them a pill. It's a lazy doctor, by the way, and so the doctor does share the blame and the responsibility. But the climate is not conducive because, again, you know, since 1997, the FDA has allowed drug companies to advertise directly to the consumer, and that's 18% of their advertising campaigns. And the only two countries in the world, in industrialized countries, where that's legal is here and in New Zealand. And I don't think New Zealand farmers on their dirt roads and on their farms are listening as closely as we are.
So doctors are to blame because patients are coming to them and saying they want this magical elixir. And
doctors are to blame because I have to take responsibility for what I write on a prescription pad. Never mind how many sexy young girls come in here bringing free lunches and pens that say this and that and trips everywhere, which, you know, they found ways to continue to do. And, you know, when patients come in here saying, "I saw this on TV," and you quickly get past the aspirin onto the fancy drug, I think we're a lazy society and we do look for pills very, very quickly, but I think it's engineered by the drug companies. You and I are in total agreement on that.
Mark, can you hold on for another segment?
Of course I can.
I appreciate it. Mark Siegel is an internist and the author of a new book. Great read, by the way, if you really want to get past the hype and down to the reality of the situation of this fearful America that we're living in. Get a copy of this book called False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Dr. Mark Siegel. His new book is called False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. Of course, there's a link to it on my website, harrisonline.com. Maybe that'll help you sell a couple extra copies here or there, Mark. You were on duty in New York City on the morning of 9/11/01. And before we get back to the stuff in the book here, I'd love to hear a little bit of your first-person experience that morning. Where were you? What happened? Where'd you go?
Well, you know, that experience is actually what started this and led me to write the book. That plus the fears I noticed in my patients after 9/11, which weren't always in proportion to their risk. But on 9/11, I was driving down the FDR Drive in New York, and I saw a bunch of ambulances passing me, and they lined up to exit at Bellevue Hospital, which is one of my two home hospitals. I followed them, and I didn't know what they were doing there, and I got to the hospital, and it was turning over in a minute into a triage center for emergencies, and I found out quickly what had happened, and then I joined, you know, I've been in that hospital for many years, so I became, you know, one of the temporary or appointed heads of the emergency service down there, and we waited for the patients to come from the World Trade Center site, and a few people trickled in with burns and, you know, some workers, but ultimately the vast slew of patients we were expecting never came. They emptied the hospital, they triaged and transferred all the patients, and by the end of the night, Bellevue was a ghost hospital waiting for survivors that didn't come. But what I learned from that experience was obviously not only that, you know, that many people had died in the World Trade Center attack, but I learned that our sense of the extent of something was actually beyond the actual event, because, you know, we were expecting, you know, many, many more people than actually got injured, and 3,000 was terrible, but I think what actually happened from 9/11 was that the whole country's psyche got got very, very injured, and that made us feel very vulnerable going forward.
Of course, the great news about that day is you had a potential of 50,000 people being hurt or killed, and 3,000 is a tremendous number, but you got 47,000 people who escaped without fatality there. That whole day you were just waiting to work on people and no one came in?
Well, we were working on the people that came in, but the people that came in were mainly people that had suffered small injuries, or workers, or burned people, or people with emotional trauma. But the other thing that we learned from that day, which I wrote a couple of articles on at the time, was the way that people banded together, and there was a positive emotion there. It wasn't fear. It was people feeling courage and caring and, you know, commitment and not afraid. I think the reaction in New York that day was much more courage than fear, and that's a much more positive emotion. It turns out, by the way, that courage goes through the same center of the brain as fear does. And I think what we've done to ourselves as a society that's a mistake is we've used that center, the amygdala it's called. It's an almond-shaped organ in the center of the brain that we inherit from animals. We've bombarded it with worry signals rather than courage. But on 9/11, what I saw was courage.
Does being afraid weaken us physically?
Well, not only does it weaken us, but it puts us at great risk for other diseases. When we become afraid, we initiate a cycle of hormone release, stress hormones they're called, adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol. These stress hormones cause the heart to beat faster, blood pressure to go up. They put more stress on every organ in the body, and they lead to many diseases, including heart disease and stroke and depression and even cancer. So some of the things that we really ought to be worrying about are the things that we get from excess worry.
So I can actually see a circle here where Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, exploits something, makes you afraid, then the fear makes you physically need more stuff from Big Pharma.
Well, that cycles for sure. We become afraid by many signals in our society, and then, you know, we become sedentary and afraid, very unhealthy. We sit there and absorb, unmoving without exercise, because the kind of hormones that you release with exercise, by the way, don't build up fear. They build up courage. So we absorb these signals from a seating position on our couch, and then from there, we take those stress hormones, they wear us down, we go right to the pharmacy and buy drugs for them, absolutely.
Or donuts, in my case.
Well, probably donuts may actually be healthier, although not very.
You heard it, ladies and gentlemen. An MD on this show said donuts healthier.
Well, you know what? I think if you run for a half an hour on your treadmill and drink a bunch of water afterwards, and then have one donut during the day with a cup of coffee, I think you're going to be all right.
Yeah, I've got that backwards. I'm doing the donuts for a half hour.
Me too.
That's my problem. Is this unique to America? Are other countries and cultures susceptible to this in the same way we are, and is it exploited the same way there?
You know, this is one of my favorite questions, and the answer to that is that it's not identical, and we've been, I don't want to say laughed at, because, really there is some of this culture of fear in other societies, and right now, taking the bird flu, for example, it's a worldwide fear. People being fumigated in cars in Turkey, the whole idea of quarantining a human being when it's not even a human disease is based on fear. I can't say that England is immune when their consumption of chicken went down by one-third when a single parrot got it in England, or when mad cow disease drove them crazy for 10 years there, a disease that affected 100,000 cows but only 100 people. Species barriers protect us, but not from fear. So it's a worldwide problem, but I think we're a lot more, we're a lot more fear-prone here. We have a soft underbelly in this country. You know, the thing that Europe has is it's been through the world wars on their soil. And so, you know, many, many people in Europe have a different philosophy. You know, they've been through true events where they were threatened. I mean, imagine what it felt like in London in the 1940s to hear bombs going off every night. You probably had to do the same kind of math that I'm advertising now, which is you could say, well, a bomb is going off, but not in my house. And we don't want to do that math now. And I actually have heard and talked to many people who said that during the London bombings in July of 2005, the city handled it a lot better than Omaha, Nebraska handled the same news.
You know, it's funny you say that because I was thinking of that exact example as I was reading through your book, thinking of the subway bombings in London earlier this year, because I remember watching the coverage of that, and I get a BBC channel on my satellite TV in addition to all the American news networks, and the coverage here was hysterical. I mean, it was absolutely not funny hysterical, but full of hysteria. You put on the BBC, and they've not only got the stiff upper lip presentation and the lack of hysteria in their presentation, but even the English citizens that they talk to on the streets sort of had this stiff upper lip attitude, and it must have come from being generationally used to stuff like this after World War II.
Well, and it's because it's not just the people that have experienced it. It's what they teach their children. Another question I'm fond of answering is, what do we tell our children? And I always reply, you know, if you're not afraid, your children aren't going to be afraid. Children hear the same news you do. They're looking to you to put it in proper context. You want your children to be worried unnecessarily for the rest of their lives? You're going to give them neuroses. So I think, you know, in Europe, maybe the younger generation in London, even though they didn't live through World War II, has seen, you know, their parents and grandparents live through World War II and learn how to cope.
And maybe that time passing, 60 years since World War II, has helped them with that stiff upper lip attitude. Maybe 60 years after 9/11, the United States will have that same sort of attitude. But if the various groups that we're talking about exploiting this continue to do so, I think we're headed down the wrong path, which is one of the things you point out about, which leads me to my last question for you, Mark. What do we do about it?
Well, you know, the first answer to that question, Paul, is that I have a hunch, and maybe it's because I'm an optimist, that our public is not as dumb as our leaders are thinking. You know, let's manipulate the public one more time with another fear message. I mean, I think that some of that is growing old and tired. Those things are not working as well. You know, some advertisement before an election that shows a bunch of wolves circling in the forest, and that's supposed to represent Al-Qaeda or something. I mean, I think the public is wising up a bit. Another thing that would help is to not obsess on these fear messages, because, you know, I love cable TV, but if you turn it on for 24 hours, you're going to just get bombarded, and you're going to think those airplanes going down are all there are. And the third thing we've already hinted at is the positive emotions that you can replace that go through the same fear center of the brain. Courage and caring and laughter and joy. Even sex goes through that. Love goes through that center of the brain. So strong positive emotions, routines, disciplines, business as usual. And here's something we haven't talked about today, Paul. Go-to people. Because one of the reasons that we have such a culture of fear in this society is we've lost the people we can rely on to tell us the truth. We've got the internet. We've got sound bites, info bites. You know, we're getting information from a million sources, but is that reliable information? We need to go back to the leather-handed pharmacist, you know, of the 1950s, who could say, you know, this is safe for you and this isn't. Now, of course, I'm romanticizing that. Probably that pharmacist was telling you the wrong thing. But out there, there should be people that are committed enough to what they're doing to say, my job is not to scare people. My job is to inform people.
You left out donuts.
Well, that's right. Well, the donut manufacturers are probably a little bit, at least with some of the ones that I eat, they're a little bit more honest about it. I think nobody's saying that a donut is good for you.
Or that if you don't eat a donut, you're going to have something horrible is going to happen
exactly.
to you.
Exactly. So donuts are honest. We can agree on that.
Yeah. And now I'm thinking somebody who's been listening to us for the last half hour is too afraid that they've become too afraid. That's something you consult your doctor on that and make it Dr. Mark Siegel. The book is called False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. I've enjoyed our chat here today. Mark, thank you.
Thanks. Anytime.
It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.